As lawmakers meet in special session, healthcare leaders here in Jacksonville say a deal on Medicaid funding is do or die. Your calls just ahead. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live at 9, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we welcome the CEO of UF Health as he speaks out on the critical issue of hospital funding in Florida and why you need to care about it. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, melanoma, the dark side of summer. Mayo Clinic's national expert with advice on keeping your skin protected and the latest research. Plus, a conversation with New York Times bestselling author Mary Alice Monroe. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, can Florida get a deal on Medicaid? The Florida House and Senate are back in Tallahassee this week after ending their regular session 3 days early. Things fell apart after the two chambers couldn't agree on how to get health insurance to the state's low-income residents. The standoff has real consequences for health care in our area, particularly at UF Health Jacksonville, the former Shands. That hospital's leadership says the cuts in low-income pool funding, or LIP funding as it's known, that are being proposed by the governor could put them out of business. If there's no UF Health, there's no Trauma One. And that has an amazingly damaging ripple effect across our region. UF Health CEO Russ Armistead has been speaking out on this issue, and he joins us now in studio with his thoughts about the way forward for healthcare funding in Florida. Russ, great to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And the number to join the show, what are your questions about this healthcare standoff in Florida? The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show, and we also welcome your comments on Facebook. Okay, so after melting down 3 days early, the House and Senate are being pulled back to Tallahassee. They simply must pass a budget. It's their constitutional obligation. Let's go back to the meltdown and bring people up to speed. The two chambers could not agree on this issue over the low-income pool funding. It's a complicated issue, but can you explain to our listeners why this is so important for your hospital?
Sure, I'll take a shot. It is complicated, but it's also relatively simple. We are one of 14 safety net hospitals in the state of Florida. We have, of those 14, we have the highest of percentage of Medicaid and uninsured business. Medicaid's a low payer, and of course, uninsured is a zero payer. And coupled with that, we have also the lowest commercial business. So our financial structure is weak, balance sheet's weak, and we live hand to mouth, as unfortunately some folks in the community do. We need our paycheck every week or every 2 weeks to survive. So part of our financing structure is this lower income pool, which in total is $95 million. The issue in Tallahassee really broke down, I believe, because you have both the low income pool, which is a continuing program, and you have the president's program of Medicaid expansion. And philosophically, no matter where you are on that, those issues were tied together and are tied together by the Senate. And the House is appears not to be interested in expansion, and thus they couldn't agree on a deal. And those two things linked together created what I believe was the problem.
And now, as the House and Senate convene once again, the tone between the two chambers quite different. The Florida Senate has put forth a proposal that would be a sort of hybrid of Medicaid expansion. What are your thoughts about that proposal?
Well, being in the healthcare business, it's pretty easy for me to say that I support expansion. It would help us. It helps hospitals. It really doesn't change the care, except hopefully it would allow people who don't have insurance today to be seen by a physician in a primary care office and keep them out of an emergency room. And so while I think expansion would be good for the healthcare industry, people in Tallahassee disagree. And so, you know, I respect their opinion. that issue will continue to cloud our health care in this state, I believe, for some years, because the federal government wants the states to expand. And this LIP issue, we're talking about a reduction in funds from the federal government. It's their right to do that. And in order to compensate for that, I believe it's going to take state general revenue, which takes money away from other programs. So that's what our House and Senate will have to deal with, is what they're willing to give up in order to maintain their philosophic position.
We'll go to your calls for UF Health Jacksonville CEO Russ Armistead in just a moment at 549-2937. What are your thoughts about Governor Scott's proposal? He submitted a letter Tuesday to the Fed saying that, in his view, UF Health Jacks would lose nearly $37 million under his low-income pool proposal.
Well, since I can't afford to lose any, it's pretty easy for me to say I can't support that proposal. If that were to go forward, I would be out of cash in 6 to 9 months. So it's a non-starter for me and for the patients here, more importantly, the patients here in Jacksonville that we provide life and death health care to.
UF Health Jacksonville, some may still know it as the former Shands, is the safety net hospital for this region. It also is the only level one trauma center for many miles around. It has the proton beam, which is advanced cancer care. You're also building a facility, or you have built a facility, on Jacksonville's north side to offset some of these funding challenges. If UF Health were to close its doors, can you explain what that scenario might mean for healthcare across our region?
Sure. I think people can't believe in the issue that I try to pay a lot of attention to is I think people don't believe it could ever happen. This is not new. This happens every year. I've been here. This is my third year. This is the most difficult, the most, I'll say, treacherous time we've had. But in the last couple of years, we had $30 million issues in Tallahassee that would have closed us. And the legislature, in their wisdom, figured out how to keep us going. So my hope, and I think the community's hope, is that the legislature will fund our need. The reality is, at some point, I believe the city of Jacksonville is going to have to provide more funds for us, or, as you mentioned, describe a meltdown. I'm reminded of Winston Churchill. It says Americans will always do the right thing after they have tried every other option. Didn't quote him exactly right.
That's about right, though, yeah.
You got the gist of it. And so we would have, so what would happen is, first of all, we'd lose the trauma designation, trauma center. And that would mean patients would go other places, Gainesville, Orlando, pick your spot. We're seeing 90,000 emergency room visits. We wouldn't be able to manage that volume. We've got 500 and about 40 patients in our hospital. The other hospitals literally don't have the capacity to manage and take those patients or take those 90,000 emergency room visits. So it would be a catastrophic mess on the healthcare side. The second thing is, we're a $500 million business in Northwest Jacksonville. And the economic impact of us not being there would set Jacksonville back 5 to 7 years. So it shouldn't happen. It can happen. I'm very comfortable the legislature will figure out how to keep us going. I just don't know how many years in the future they will continue to solve our local problem.
Do you think eventually Jacksonville will have to get serious about an independent taxing district of some sort for UF Health, the way that the safety net hospitals in Tampa and Miami are funded?
Yes, I do. I think that's going to have to happen. We're trying. The idea of the facility in the north does two things. One, it serves that community, which really has lacked health care for years. And the second thing is, just as you mentioned, to improve our payer mix. The system today, people forget, what happens is Intergent Care is funded at each hospital. And if you have a taxing authority like Miami-Dade or in Orlando or Tampa, those funds help the hospital provide that care. And if you otherwise, you need a hospital that makes a lot of money, and the way you make a lot of money is frankly from commercially insured patients, which we lack. So part of the North strategy is to improve that payer mix. But the size of the issue, that's multi-years, 5, 7, maybe even 10 years away from solve. I don't even know if it'll solve the problem, but certainly would go a long way towards solving that problem. That's assuming that we continue to allow this healthcare system to overcharge commercial patients. That's really the essence of the issue. And that's not the right way to go, I don't believe, but that's the way the healthcare system operates today.
And do you feel that the changes that are embedded within the Affordable Care Act will bend the cost curve the way it should go or not?
No, it certainly doesn't do anything to bend the cost curve. And that's what a number of people object to. What it does is just provide resources to people who are seen today at places like mine that don't have resources. So it just switches the payer from the hospital to the insurance company and does nothing to manage that care. The good news is it forces places like us to try to get these patients out of the emergency room and into primary care clinics.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, for UF Health Jacksonville CEO Russ Armistead on the state's healthcare funding crisis as lawmakers are hauled back to Tallahassee to meet in special session. 549-2937, Andrew on the west side. Hi, Andrew. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Go ahead.
I did have a question about the care you guys are talking about in the SHANS program that is being canceled out. You say the funding is limited, but maybe it's the doctors that should be funding it, since I myself am a former SHANS program. They had very lack of attention to detail when I was there. Half the patients that were there were unemployable, disabled, or almost homeless because they can't find jobs. And they always complain about the care. If you actually sat in the facilities, it's not something that you would really seem to want to fund anyways. I've been on the west side, the north side, the south side of Jacksonville for the SHANS program. It's not really something that I'd care for ever again. I finally got United Healthcare insurance.
Thanks for okay, Andrew. Thanks for the call. Russ.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm sorry you had a bad experience. The so-called SHANS card is really a city card. We get $26 million from the city to provide care to individuals who qualify, and that tends to be about 10,000 of the 140,000 in Jacksonville that do not have health insurance. We try hard to provide the same level of care to anyone. Our physicians, frankly, don't even know who has insurance and who doesn't. I'm sorry you had a bad experience. I'll invite you to come back. I can tell you that we interview patients in our hospital and ask them how we're doing. And our results are pretty good. It sounds like your solution would be for us to close. And, you know, I hear you. The problem is if we close, all of these other folks don't, the only option they have is to go wait at another hospital. So it's not a great system. We do try to provide the best care we can. I'm sorry you had a bad experience. Come back.
And as you've pointed out, if there is no UF Health, the ERs around the city, we're talking Baptist, St. Luke's, Memorial, and others, they will be absolutely overflowing with patients, they will not be able to meet the demand. And all of the hospital CEOs have spoken out about this in Jacksonville, haven't they?
Yes. The hospitals in Jacksonville, the healthcare system, is actually what I'll say— it's busy. All the hospitals are busy, all the emergency rooms. If you go to most emergency rooms, you will wait at least 20, 30 minutes up to a few hours. the 90,000 patients we see annually, you dump that on the existing healthcare system, well, they just couldn't accommodate it. One, two, there's no trauma center, and three, they don't have the inpatient capacity to admit patients from the emergency room that would need additional hospitalization.
Andy is in Riverside. Andy, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I've got a question about the emergency rooms. We've heard it mentioned that it's bad for the healthcare system when people use the emergency rooms as primary care. Yet there's a proliferation of billboards up and down the interstate where these hospitals are advertising that there's only a 5-minute wait for the emergency. Why are they reaching out to people if they don't want them using them for anything other than a significant emergency?
Andy, thanks.
Yeah, great question. Earlier I said the way the healthcare system works today is we overcharge and make money off commercial insurance. So those billboards are out there to encourage people who have insurance to come to the hospital so we can make money, and we use that money to fund the healthcare for people who don't have resources. There's a federal law that requires anyone who walks into an emergency room must be treated irregardless of resource. We just happen to be a place where more people without resources come. You will wait longer than 5 minutes in our emergency room on 8th Street. In the north, the wait is less, and that's part of our whole strategy. But this is, again, what most people don't understand is in emergency rooms, when people don't have health insurance, it is the only option they have except for some of the free clinics we have around the city. There is just nowhere else for them to go. And the billboards, trust me, are not advertising to those people. They're advertising to those of us who are blessed that have commercial insurance.
Lots of calls. Meanwhile, if you're just tuning in, our guest right now is UF Health Jacks CEO Russ Armistead, as he talks about what's at stake for health care in Florida as lawmakers meet in special session this month to try to resolve their dispute over how to cover the state's low-income patients. Lots of calls at 549-2937, and we'll go to your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments, lots of those too, in just a moment. Van in downtown Jacks. Hi, Van. Good morning.
I think they got my name wrong. This is Matt.
Oh, sorry about that. Go ahead, Matt.
That's totally fine. I'm a veteran with a chronic disease, and anytime that, you know, I get a flare-up or something goes wrong, I have to drive all the way to Gainesville. Now, this is a microcosm of what will happen if this hospital closes and how important it is to keep it open, because it's an hour and a half away, as you know, and it's the only place where I'm personally allowed to be seen. Well, if you convert that over to people that are in necessitating a trauma one, you know, you've got, I mean, it's like you said before, it's just going to be completely overflown with patients that are going to need this. So it's really important that people actually get out there and, you know, this is what you voted for, this is what you got. So, you know, next election, think about who you're putting in office and the kind of things that they're going to put on our system to just strain us all completely and put us in this erratic behavior where we feel like we've got to now scramble to do something where we knew this was coming, we knew this was going to happen. This guy just lets stuff like this go on with seemingly no conscience.
Thank
That's
you.
All I got to say about that.
Thank you, Matt. That's Matt calling from downtown. And when we talk about the politics of this, I'm quoting from the Florida Times Union. Reporter Tia Mitchell writes, proponents of Medicaid expansion are already starting to talk about what they can do over the fall and winter as they look forward to trying again in 2016 when House Republicans may be more willing to support a Medicaid expansion alternative in an election year. Russ Armistead, will the political pressure on this force a change next year, as Matt tried to point out in his call?
Gosh, I don't know. The philosophic differences in Tallahassee are very strong. There's so much money in the Medicaid program that, you know, we're talking almost $4 or $5 billion a year. And I don't know whether Florida is going to be willing to do any kind of expansion for a number of years. I think the reality is starting to hit, which will be, in order to avoid expansion, it's going to soak up a fair amount of the state's budget, and ultimately that'll become unacceptable.
Florida State Representative Paul Renner from our area, Republican in Palm Coast, quoted as saying that many in the Florida House are dubious about the Senate's plan to expand Medicaid. They don't know whether the federal government will even approve it. They call Medicaid a dysfunctional system that would have a long-term deleterious effect on the state budget. That's the philosophical divide. Those in the Florida House, they see Medicaid as nothing but dysfunction and draining the state's budget. What's your thought about that?
I believe that's correct where they are coming from. The state has expanded or has established a Medicaid managed care program, which is slightly different. As I mentioned earlier, the difficulty is the Medicaid expansion doesn't do anything to reduce cost. It just provides dollars to individuals so that it shifts who's paying from the hospital today to this government program. My sense is the program is dysfunctional. I think the managed care initiative that Florida has embarked on is a good strategy. I think the system is so complicated that you have to work with it as opposed to just ignoring it. And so that's what I would encourage the legislators to think about. I've been in this business a long time, and I can't figure out how to do something that would so radically change that it would be better. I think we just have to do something and then modify it as we go.
Margaret tweets the show, Governor Scott intimately knows health care. Does it anger you that he isn't more supportive of what U of Health provides in Jacksonville?
Well, I try to keep my personal feelings out of this. The governor clearly understands health care, and the governor has taken the positions he has for reasons that only he knows. And so while I disagree with him, I don't get mad about he or anyone else does. My job is just to give the facts, stay with it, and, you know, if I do the right thing, it'll work out.
Here's a comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. I know U of Health just opened a new birthing center on the north side. What will be the impact on that facility?
Well, the north is a part of our license. And so anything that happens on 8th Street happens to the north. So it is not an isolated island that's going to sit out there by itself. If we're in trouble, they're in trouble.
Let's go to Ray in Orange Park now. Hey, Ray, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Melissa. I'm calling to agree or commiserate with the CEO of Shands. I think we have a dishonest government. On the one hand, we claim that we are anti-social medicine. But on the other hand, the reality is that the taxing district, which is really what we need, is social medicine. We have to either agree as a society that we're going to fund for the poor and disenfranchised and provide adequate funding, or we have to be honest about our policies and say if we don't fund it, then everyone must have insurance. And I think the CFOs and CEOs of hospitals need to go to Supreme Court and challenge the unconstitutionality of a law that requires them to provide free service, where if I go to post office and demand a passport, and if I don't pay for it, I don't get it. If I go to DMV and ask for a driver's license, and if I can't pay for it, the government is not going to give me a driver's license. So we have a law that requires them to provide free service at the worst possible time. I mean, people, I know of healthcare providers who tell me that people use ER as a place to get sobered up and get a shower at $1,000 a day cost, because we don't have any place for the poor and injured to go.
Okay, right.
So I think the system is broken, and either we have to be honest and accept social medicine, or we have to tell people that, unfortunately, they have to die because we don't have a system that cares for them.
Ray, thanks for your thoughts. Teresa in Jacksonville. Hi, Teresa. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just actually want to say my background is an emergency room nurse in Jacksonville and as a visiting nurse currently in Jacksonville. And actually, I see all the positive effects of people with CHAMS cards, people who get care at CHAMS. I have an enormous respect for the people working at CHAMS. Every time I call to get appointments for my patients, the community, they're so incredibly professional. I have no problems getting a hold of anybody. And I just wanted to say, as far as the city of Jacksonville, I'm amazed moving to Jacksonville from Atlanta, where in Atlanta we had our taxes, our county taxes that supported Grady Memorial Hospital, that was the trauma center, and part of our taxes went towards that. I was amazed that Jacksonville is pretty spoiled for Duval County that they don't pay for taxes to support the hospital. So I was wondering, is that something in the future that they're talking about and looking at, as opposed to worrying about funding, you know, lip funding and blah, 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 and all that stuff?
Sure,
just
sure.
Wondering.
Sure. Thank you, Teresa. And so funding from the county, that's a separate issue, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's going to get right up to the table, I think, fairly quickly. The county does provide funds for us for indigent care. They provided $24 million for 14 years without change. A couple of years ago, they increased it by $2.5 million to $26 million. That give you a sense, probably the best funded hospital in our state, I would say, is Jackson Memorial. They're twice the size we are, and they get 13 times the local support. Mm. We don't need 13 times the local support, but it's a pension kind of number. We need $40 or $50 million instead of the 26. And Jacksonville, I've been here 3 years. It's a no tax. You open your mouth about taxes politically, and you're not going to get elected. So, frankly, unless the community thinks this is an important issue, it won't happen, and that'll be to everyone's detriment.
In the short term, you are hopeful for at least a resolution to this crisis, and then, of course, we want to keep speaking with you about the long term. Your final thoughts?
Yeah, thanks again for your time and for the callers who had comments, both positive and negative. We work hard to make sure we provide every patient who presents the best care that we can provide. With the trauma center, we an educational center, we have roughly 350 physicians who are in training, and we're proud of what we do. And so we hope the community is willing to back us, and I believe ultimately it's going to need more local support. You can agree or disagree with me, but we are what we are. We provide this heavy load of indigent care. I think the other hospitals are actually glad we're here, because if we weren't here, they'd have what we have. We like what we do. We're proud of it, and we want to continue to do it. So I just would ask the community to consider supporting us, not only verbally, but with their money.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We were joined by Russ Armistead, the CEO of UF Health here in Jacksonville, and we'll continue to follow this issue throughout the month. Much more still ahead later. New music spinning this week in the Electro Lounge, plus a conversation with best-selling author Mary Alice Monroe. But up next, protecting your skin during beach season, a Mayo Clinic expert, right after this.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
This summer, WJCT will introduce several new programs to our weekend schedule. We want your help deciding which new shows come to the First Coast. Starting May 10th, tune in Sundays at 1 o'clock for a special preview of The Moth Radio Hour, Snap Judgment, Wits, and Studio 360. Help us decide what you hear on 89.9. Get more information at wjct.org/weekends.
New name, new look, great information. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Good for You is a day of celebrating women's health planned just for you. Great speakers, great food, health screenings, and so much more. Hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to WJCT/goodforyou.
Welcome back. Well, beach season is here. Time to enjoy the sun, but also be safe and protect your skin. That's because the American Cancer Society estimates more than 135,000 new cases of melanoma are diagnosed in the U.S. each year. Melanoma is the deadliest form of skin cancer, but there are new treatments to talk about, and they're being developed right here in town. Richard Joseph, MD, is an oncologist with the Department of Hematology and Oncology at Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville, and he's a nationally recognized expert on melanoma. Dr. Joseph, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me again.
Great to have you on the show. And, you know, I go and get that mole check every year. I've had several removed because I'm so fair-skinned living here in Florida, and I know I'm not alone. 135,000 new cases each year. That's really alarming for melanoma in this country.
It is, and it's one of the fastest-growing cancers in terms of rates. You know, a lot of cancers are going down with all the screening. We have colonoscopies now to prevent colon cancer, and people are smoking less, so we have lung cancers going down. But for whatever reason, and probably the sun tanning booths out there increasing is probably increasing the rates of melanoma at the fastest rate of any cancer.
Interesting. And let's define melanoma and why it's such a deadly form of skin cancer if it's not caught early.
Sure. So melanoma is a different form of skin cancer. There's three primary skin cancers, squamous cell, basal cell, and melanoma. Melanoma is when the melanocytes of our skin, and those are the cells of our skin that actually make us tan, and they're there to protect us from the sun. But when one of those cells turn to cancer, that's called melanoma. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, they are extremely aggressive. So 1 millimeter of melanoma is probably equal to, you know, 20 millimeters of a breast cancer.
The signs are, I believe there's an ABCD acronym you need to know to look for the signs of melanoma. Is that right?
Sure, there is. An easy mnemonic is ABCDE, which the dermatologist, and again, I'm not a dermatologist, but if you look for asymmetry, would be A. B is irregular borders. C is if you have more than one color. D is if the diameter is greater than 8 millimeters or about the size of the tip of a pencil eraser. And E is if it's evolving. So if you have something that's changing on your skin, you know, but what I do want to encourage, don't do a self-diagnosis. Just go in and get your skin checks.
That's right. Go and have the mole check done. Now, we need to brag on you a little. You've been named the Melanoma Physician of the Year by an international foundation. Cutting-edge therapy going on at Mayo Clinic to treat patients. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So right now is just a really an amazing time for melanoma, and it's a great time to be a melanoma doctor because what we're finally able to do is treat patients by using their own immune systems to fight cancer. So what's great about using the immune system is we have an actual living being, if you will, the immune system that can evolve with the cancer as the cancer evolves. So cancer loves to evolve. So for instance, if we pressure it with one certain type of drug, well, yeah, you can kill some of the melanomas, but then the ones that are resistant, just like an antibiotic or a bacteria that becomes resistant, cancer becomes resistant. But if you treat it with an immune system, the immune system will evolve as the tumor evolves, and that can keep it away and cause long-term remissions and cures. So say 5 years ago, just as little as 5 years ago, the survival rate for melanoma at 5 years was 5%. As of today, 5 years later, it's closer to 40 to 50% of people will be alive if diagnosed with metastatic melanoma at 5 years. And so if you think about it, literally for the last 200 years, we had no breakthroughs. In the last 5 years, we've increased the rate from 5% to probably closer to 40 and 50.
That's a huge leap forward.
It is.
It's incredible.
It's so good that I'm starting to worry about people not taking it as serious as a primary prevention. So I still want people to prevent. That's still the best cure. But yeah, it's been an amazing 5 years.
And of course, it's common sense, but as we all head out to the ocean and to the pool, we need to repeat it again and again. With your children too, get out that sunscreen and use it. And mm-hmm. and people don't put on enough, do they? They think they might put on a little bit when they first go out, and then they don't reapply it. You have to keep putting it on.
That's the key. Everyone asks me that. You know, what sunscreen do you use? And mm-hmm. the answer is, I use a 30. I use whatever on sale, and I use a lot of it. So I keep uh-huh. reapplying. And you know, that's, I think, one of the biggest mistakes I see people make is they'll put it on before they go, and then they'll be at the beach for 8 hours and never reapply. And that's just not going to work.
Let me ask you too. A lot of guys, I think, have that feeling of invincibility, and they might not be as diligent about it as their wives. Mm-hmm. Do you see more male patients, especially as they get older? Because I worry about my own husband. He mm-hmm. spends a lot of time in the sun. He goes surfing, and mm-hmm. he'll come home with burns. As we get older, we're more at risk,
yeah.
aren't we?
So you make a good point, and actually it's supported by facts. So the lifetime risk for a male getting melanoma, 1 out of 37 males will get melanoma in their lifetime. For females, it's 1 out of about 60. So the males get melanoma close to a double rate than females. Now, perhaps that's actually due to some genetic or sex differences in hormones, or perhaps, you know, men are a tendency to work outside perhaps more. So who
yeah,
knows what the real cause is.
Spending time outside.
Exactly.
So if you're doing lawn work, guys, mowing the lawn, if you're out at the beach, whatever you're doing in our Florida sun, you've got to protect yourself. It really can't be stressed enough.
Absolutely. And I'm not perfect. I mean, I play golf. I go to the beach with my family, but I wear a lot of sunscreen. I wear hats. I bring umbrellas to the beach. So, you know, you can still go outside. We live in Florida. Nobody wants everybody to be inside all the time, but there's ways to be smart about it.
Here's a tweet from a listener. My father passed away of melanoma. African Americans can get it too. Everyone needs to take care of their skin.
That's true. One of the most famous people to die from melanoma is actually Bob Marley, who developed a melanoma underneath his toe. He was a soccer player, thought it was a bruise. Turned out to be melanoma, and he passed away from metastatic melanoma.
So we all must be very mindful of this. Mm-hmm. And so kudos on all your success in this field, Dr. Joseph. Thanks for spreading the word with our listeners.
Thanks for having me.
We were joined by Dr. Richard Joseph, oncologist at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Up next, a conversation with best-selling author Mary Alice Monroe and our own new music on the Electro Lounge. Stay with us.
Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4,
uh-huh.
and it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition, up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen tomorrow.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on 89.9.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Welcome back. Well, in the powerful and heartwarming conclusion to her best-selling Low Country Summer Trilogy, New York Times best-selling author Mary Alice Monroe brings her readers back to the charm of Sullivan's Island, South Carolina, in a tale of family bonds and true love. I spoke with Monroe about her new one. It's called Summer's End. Mary Alice Monroe, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm delighted. I'm delighted and looking forward to being with you all in Florida.
Yes, several appearances in our area to talk about.
It's my usual, we call it my usual tour. I go to the same stores and I see people and I love to come back.
Well, your fans will be excited to have you back. Tell us a little bit about The Summer's End.
This is the third book in this series. It's a trilogy, but Summer Girls is number one, The Summer Wind, and then The Summer's End concludes. And each book stands alone. So if someone, for example, bought The Summer's End, the last one, I worked very hard to make sure that they were up to date and they could move right into the next chapter. Each book focuses on another girl. But of course, it's a trilogy. You want to start with Summer Girls if you can. So y'all have time to read Summer Girls and Summer Wind before I get there.
Uh-huh. And when you conclude the trilogy, for fans of your work are really familiar with the world you write about, but for those that aren't, yeah, you very much deal in the culture and the feel of the Lowcountry. Can you tell us a little bit about how your love of that region of America informs the stories that you write?
Absolutely. This is, the Lowcountry is sort of a bastion of Southern culture, I believe, and great landscape. You would come here and see this gorgeous, the rivers and the creeks and that meander through the marshes and, of course, the ocean and the mountains, and it's just breathtaking. And, of course, in Florida, you have quite the landscape yourselves. But I think also here, the traditions and values that are rooted so deep. And when I create the characters, I look to my inspiration from the animals to inspire what aspect I should touch on in a novel. So for this trilogy, it was the dolphin. And we all love the dolphin. All of us do. But dolphins are in trouble right now. So I look to bring my readers aware of issues facing dolphins, because I don't sugarcoat. I don't fall into the trap of nostalgia as I write my human stories. I present real issues. So when my readers finish the book, not only have they fallen in love with Mama, the grandmother, and her granddaughters, and how she guides them through this troubled time of their lives, but when they close the book, they think, gee, you know, I learned a lot about dolphins, too.
Yeah, and in fact, didn't you spend a little time at the Dolphin Research Center in Grassy Key, Florida, for your research?
I continue to do that. I come in February or March, and I have worked with them for several years, and I'm writing a book for them on one of their dolphins, Jacks. And it's because of my work with them that I understood about the Wounded Warrior projects that work with dolphins and the therapy. And I was so impressed and so moved by my experiences with our wounded warriors. And my son served in the Marines, so I'm very familiar with it. I created a hero based on what I learned, Taylor, who was introduced in The Summer Wind, but he is the hero in book three.
And it's always satisfying to read the final book in a trilogy, too. There's a symmetry to that that I think readers really like.
I worked so hard. This was my first trilogy that I ever actually knew would be designed as a trilogy, beginning, middle, and an end. With The Beach House, I wrote, and I continue to write that series every few years as I get more involved with turtles. I still am on the turtle team after all these years. For a trilogy that you design, though, I had to conclude it. I worked very hard at tying up all the loose ends and making sure my readers would not be disappointed at the end. When they read there's two grandmothers, the British grandmother from Harper's grandmother, and then Mama, the Southern grandmother, and those two grandmothers go at it, and it's hysterical. I was laughing out loud when I wrote it, and I think my readers will too. But at the end, Mama's conclusion shows my feelings as a grandmother that this is our second chance. we raised our children, but our grandchildren, not our second chance, not just for fun and presents, but to act as mentors and to pay attention to their needs. That's what Mama did with these girls, and I hope to do with my grandchildren.
Well, it's wonderful to speak with you, and we look forward to your several appearances in our area. Mary Alice Monroe,
Mary Kay. Y'all know Mary Kay Andrews?
Uh-huh.
She's a wonderful Southern author. I'm actually appearing with Mary Kay both at the Bookmark in Neptune and in Vero Beach at the Vero Beach Book Center. So the two of us are friends, and we're going to have a good time together.
It's going to be great. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed myself very much.
Lots of chances to see Mary Alice Monroe this week. She'll appear today at the Amelia Island Book Festival. So get out and see her. And finally, this hour, lots of new music spinning this week in the Electro Lounge. Some great new picks as our music director, David Luckin, cues them up. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and thanks for having me in. We're going to start with the brand new Melody Gardot CD called Currency of Man. And I've got all these notes to talk about, but let me tell you her backstory. Her backstory is she's from Philadelphia. She's riding her bike in the streets of Philly. She gets hit by a car.
Oh.
She goes into the hospital with brain injury, and the doctors say, you're going to have to remap your brain. Do you have any hobbies? And she says, well, I write a little. That's how she writes her first album.
Get out of here.
She wears dark glasses because the sun gives her migraines. So she's got these issues still. But she sings incredibly well. We've played Over the Rainbow a lot on this program and in Electro Lounge and out at Lily's and different places. But the new album is really different. It's much more rich. And here's a song called Preacher Man from the new album, Currency of Man.
Preacher man gonna tell me where his body lies. Sit it down by the river of tide, left him there to die.
Incredible.
It's
and
rich.
It all came from an accident.
Yeah.
How about that?
It's a great backstory. And what's nice about this album is she's got a kind of a conscience on this song. She's sung other songs, kind of bluesy and country and jazzy. And this album has much more conscious awareness in all the songs. And there's some jazzy ones, there's some bluesy ones, and ones like this that are just kind of like Dusty Springfield or someone in Memphis.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's a good comparison, yeah. So this is Melody Gardot, and what a sound. This is just one example of the types of new music you're cooking up on the lounge.
We're going to play a lot of this tomorrow night, and it's called Currency of Man.
Okay.
The next one is two of our favorite folks in town, and they got a group called Complicated Animals. It's Monica Da Silva and Chad Alger. And, of course, they always play for us whenever we need a band for our fundraisers. They got a great new EP out, and they live right here in town, and this is how they sound, the Complicated Animals.
They sound great. I love them.
They were at Wayne's Woodstock this
Wayne
weekend.
Wayne Woodstock, one of several local standouts to perform.
Yeah, one of our favorites. We love them. Go get that EP. It's online. Just look for Complicated Animals or find Monica on Facebook.
Last but not least, Herbie Mann, Memphis Underground, you want to talk about.
A flashback to 1969. I bought this album. Everyone I know had it. We all loved it. But, you know, I learned something new during the research this morning, that it was recorded at the American Sound Studios, which is where Elvis did some of his best work, where Dusty Springfield did her best work. So I'm enlightened as I do this. Of course, Roy Ayers, Larry Coryell, and Sonny Chirac on guitar. Here's a little Herbie Mann doing Aretha Franklin's Chain of Fools.
Nice. And, you know, you pick music from all over the country, all over the world, new artists, classic artists. You and our own inimitable Sean Birch have put together a lineup on our new Relax Radio that is just a deep, deep catalog of amazing music.
And there's a lot of Herbie Mann on Relax, too.
Let's talk a little bit about Relax. It's going strong. That's our new HD3 music channel.
And it's doing really well. We're up to 2,000 songs in rotation, so you're not going to hear this many songs anywhere on the radio. And it's everything from Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald and Barbara Streisand and Bublé to the Young Rascals, the Righteous Brothers, Elvis, the Beatles, Motown. It's all the music of your life, some TV themes, and just all the great music that we grew up with in America and around the world. And it's 24 hours a day, NPR news at the top of the hour, and then the rest of the hour, 50 minutes to forget all that news. You can just, we will make you relax. It's an interesting mix that you really are taking on a journey, you know, from Louis Armstrong to Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
It's so exciting. And if you haven't heard about Relax Radio, just go to WJCT.org and find out how you can get it. David Luckin, our music director, always great to see you. Thanks.
Thanks for having me in. And listen to the music. You know, there's no such thing as old music. It's just music you haven't heard yet.
Exactly. And we're going to close with a little more Herbie Mann from Memphis Underground. Diane Reams up next. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Enjoy the sounds.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.